the creatives, you've got this degree show, right, where you showcase your best stuff for basically employees to look at and maybe hire you. Basically, I had multiple projects showcased there, but the one that got all of the attention was the app. And at that time, I didn't really think anything about it. I was just like, I just need to find a job. Like, I was broke as hell. I just took the highest paying job. And I was I was in London at that time. So I was at a bank in central London, just working as a graphic designer. And I was just doing the most boring graphic design possible, where the main thing is to make the disclaimer as big as possible, right? In 2017, I moved to Manchester from London. I worked in that startup for a week until basically Hoops Connect happened. Here's the guy with money. I'm just gonna ask. Because if you don't ask, it's always gonna be a no, right? I just sat down the CEO of that startup and said, right, this is the idea I've got. And so that conversation took about 3 to 4 minutes after work. And he was like, let's do it. After about just over a year with Hoops Connect, we just completely failed at it. And it's mostly due to that the product was just not good enough. But the interest was there. And so at that point, it was more about, right, what do we do now? Orphy Media came about, which was is still a digital marketing and branding agency. Actually turned out really well. We had some really cool projects. We got to build a basketball team from scratch in the BBL, and I'm like a massive basketball fan. That was like a dream come true. In the beginning of 2019, we just sat down and we were like, should we have another go at this? We started completely from scratch. In just over half a year, we developed a better product and went a lot further than we did in 1.5 years with Hoops Connect.
Welcome back to another podcast. This week I'm joined by Jonas. Jonas is the founder of Orphy Active. We talk all about business, startups, tech, a bit about sport as well. It's a really interesting podcast. If you haven't already, then don't forget to press the subscribe button below. Really interesting podcast with a really interesting guy and a good friend of mine. So make sure you stay to the end and enjoy.
Back in 2017, I think we met over Instagram. In the meantime, so over the past 3 years or so, like, we've gone back and forth on Instagram. So the first time we met, I think you replied to one of my stories or something. And then I think about the year later, we met at a networking event briefly.
Yeah, completely randomly. Yeah.
Yeah, it was random. Yeah. Like,
you were a lot taller than I thought, by the way. I remember. I couldn't even recognize you, I remember. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a small circle in Manchester, isn't it? Especially with businesses and stuff like that in the tech space. So yeah, we met there, didn't we? And then I think in 2018 I went on your podcast in person, so I went to see you. And then last year, we met up when I came into your office and did some training for you. So yeah, back in 2017 you're working on Hoops Connect, so that's your app. So would you be able to go in some detail and kind of explain, you know, your journey since 2017? I know a lot's happened over the past 3 years or so. So first of all, can you kind of explain what Hoops Connect is and where you're up to today? Since 2017, it's completely rebranded, but for the listeners,
Hoops Connect, Hoops Connect is not a thing anymore, by the way. All right. It's just completely not a thing anymore. Solely because it was my first kind of proper attempt at a tech startup, right? So in 2017, I moved to Manchester from London. And my first instinct was, I was working on Hoops Connect, which at that time was actually called Fast Play. And that's a completely different story. But I came in here and I was just looking for a job, basically. And I just ended up at a startup, because I was kind of really just interested and I like the vibe of startups. So I just joined a startup in Manchester. And I worked in that startup for a week until basically Hoops Connect happened, essentially. So after about just over a year with Hoops Connect, we just completely failed at it, because I didn't know what I'm doing. It was my first first business that's kind of like a proper business, first time having employees, first time using a development language that was very young, which is called React Native. So it's just like, well, it just came out. It's a hybrid language, which means we could have developed for iOS and Android all at the same time. We didn't need separate developers and stuff like that. And so, yeah, so when we met, I think we just launched Hoops Connect publicly. And about half a year after that, we had to basically close it down. And it's mostly due to that the product was just not good enough. But the interest was there, right? So just to give a bit of a background, so the app is about connecting organizers of sport with participants, right? It's like a marketplace in essence, right? So you can come on there, like create your sporting activity, manage all the payments, attendance, and if you want to go and join an activity, you can easily find it on a map, you know, what's around you and stuff like that. So just wanted to make it easy for both sides and to have everything one place. So there was definitely an interest in it, but because we didn't have the product we wanted to have, and we just didn't have the enough resources and funds to get it where I envisioned it to get, which is basically pull the plug, I think, beginning of 2018. And so at that point, it was more about, right, what do we do now? Because we still had the staff. I think there was about four of us at that time. And we had the creatives, we had developers. My background is graphic design, so we were like, right, let's keep this going and just do something else. And this is where Orphe Media came about, which was a digital marketing and branding agency. So we essentially did that mostly just to use the skill set that we had and start generating money. And so we did that for basically full time for the whole of 2018. Again, never been a part of an agency, never ran an agency. Again, completely different from a tech startup. All of a sudden I had to like do sales to get clients and deal with clients and all that stuff, right? But it actually turned out really well. We had some really cool projects. We got to build a basketball team from scratch in the BBL. And I'm like a massive basketball fan. That was like a dream come true. And then, you know, some other really good relationships were born from that. But the interesting thing was that by the end of that year, we kept being approached by people that were really into Hoops Connect, just asking where is the platform? Like, where are we with it? You know, what's next for it? And we kept telling everybody like it's dead. Like we cut the cord, because from my mind, you know, in startup world, especially tech, speed kills. Right. And if you're not fast enough there, you know, you'll be replaced very quickly. But it turns out that it's a lot of people are trying to do this concept, but a lot of people are failing. So when I start seeing a pattern that enough people were requesting Hoops Connect to be there, I was like, this probably is still something there. So I looked at the market and I saw like new players keep coming in and then fading out because it's damn hard to execute this. And so, yeah, in 2019, in the beginning of 2019, we just sat down and we were like, should we have another go at this? You know, we know where we went wrong. We know what the people want. We did enough testing and everything else. You know, should we do this again? And so we decided that, yeah, that's a good shout, right? So we were still doing Orphe Media to keep the cash flow. And we were developing what is now Orphe Active on the side, but we started completely from scratch, completely blank slate, completely new app. So, you know, just taking all the lessons that we've learned into that. And basically in just over half a year, we developed a better product and went a lot further than we did in 1.5 years with Hoops Connect. I want to say long story short, but yeah, that's quite a long story in that already.
No, I mean, that's probably still a condensed version as well, because I know there's a lot of things along the way and like, hopefully we can extract some of those, you know, little stories coming out of it. But one thing that I think that be quite interesting to find out, especially for the listeners, is to find out like what goes before starting an app. So a lot of the things are like the experience, the skills, the expertise, but also for a lot of people have great ideas, but what tends to be an obstacle is funding and money. So How did you fund that? So initially it was Hoops Connect. How did you manage to initially fund that to get you off the ground?
So I'll bring it back even further, right? So before Hoops Connect, it was Fastplay, right? So this idea of this app came from my last year at university. So that was back in 2013, I want to say. So that's like 7 years ago, right? And so at that point, I was just a designer that loved UI, UX, and branding. And that was my game. And I was like, I just want to make cool shit, right? And I was like, I have this idea. I'm a basketball player. It's not popular in the UK. I saw a problem. I couldn't find anywhere to play basketball or to play basketball with. When I did find somebody, I saw the organizational side of things, how tedious it was for all the organizers. Like, there has to be something there. And there wasn't, right? So I started that completely as my final year's project at university. And then when you graduate from university, you have, I don't know if that's everywhere, but at least in the creatives, you've got this degree show, right? Where you showcase your best stuff for basically employees to look at and maybe hire you, basically. And so I had multiple projects showcased there, but the one that got all of the attention was the app. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. And I actually got agencies and stuff like that approaching me saying, you know, we'll help you make this happen. And at that time, I didn't really think anything about it. I was just like, I just need to find a job. Like I was broke as hell. Like I just need to find a job, graduate, and then think about that. So that's basically what I did. I just took the highest paying job. And I was I was in London at that time. So I was at a bank in central London, just working as a graphic designer. And I was just doing the most boring graphic design possible, where the main thing is to make the disclaimer as big as possible, right? and so basically I worked at that for half a year, and I basically about a few months in that, I started doing the app on the side, just kind of fiddling around with the designs in the evenings and stuff like that. And half a year in, I just realized that this is actually something that special, right? I thought that this actually might work, but I'm not, when I was growing up, I didn't think I'm going to own a business. I'm not entrepreneurial in any sense, right? I didn't know anything about business. That's not how I was brought up. And so I quickly realized I need a co-founder that's very business-minded, right? So I can do the cool designery and marketing shit, and the other guy can take care of all the business stuff, right? So I actually found my co-founder at that time from the basketball scrimmages that I used to go every Wednesday in London. So we just, we created a company, well, he did, and we just started doing that. So that was completely bootstrapped, right? So for about 2 years, that was completely, I get a salary, 80% of my salary goes there, the rest of it goes to basically rent and a couple of noodles, right? And that's it. And we used Egyptian developers who are very, very, very cheap. But at the end of the day, you get what you pay for. So we kind of dragged along the app development for 2 years, and we barely got anywhere. I remember we reached a point where I had quite a bit of like financial troubles, and I still had to pay the developers. And basically it was funny, like when you think about it from the side, like I was working, you know, in a financial institution in the central bank, and rather than going home, I would go and sleep on the street with my laptop and my freaking suit, wake up and then go to central bank again. Like it's just meant that only took maybe a week and a half or something like that. Then I did find like a shared accommodation above a pub. So I lived there for a couple of months because it was like 15 quid a night or something like that. But you don't think that when you come into the office and you look all nice and dandy, right? So bootstrapping didn't really work for us. And I realized that the developers that we were investing in, you know, it's we just couldn't get to the product that we want to get. And we needed funding. And I basically brought that to my co-founder at the time, and I just said, these developers aren't just not working out. Like, we're putting money in and it's just nothing's happening. You know, we either need to switch developers or try and find funding or figure something else out. And basically, this is where we had differences in the beliefs. And there's a bit more in the backstory as well. But essentially, that's where we parted ways. And that's when I decided to move to Manchester. So when I did move to Manchester, my main thing was like, all right, Fastplay's done, right? So my co-founder still continued doing it. He owned then at that point basically the majority of the company. And I was like, I just need to find a job. I got a new girlfriend. We moved in just together in Manchester, and I was like, I need to find something. And that's when I joined the startup that I mentioned in here. And the reason I worked in that startup for only a week was I just sat down the CEO of that startup and said, right, this is the idea I've got. You know, we actually have a prototype. We know there's interest. We have a high level business plan. We know how we're going to make money with it. I just need the fuel, right? And so that conversation took about 3 to 4 minutes after work. And he was like, let's do it. And that was pretty much it, right? So I've never really went out and raised an angel round or seed round or whatever. Maybe I didn't do any pitch decks or anything like that. It was very much, here's the guy with money. I'm just going to ask. Because if you don't ask, it's always going to be a no, right? So I just asked. He said yes. And then the next thing was, right, I need to hire a developer, right? And I need to hire a shit-hot developer full-time, right? And that's how we got funding. And we still basically work with the same person.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Like that 3 or 4 minute conversation, you know, would you say it changed your life in some ways? Completely?
In some way. Do you know what? Like at that point, there were so many things going on mm-hmm. that when you're kind of, when you're just in the corner right that, and you basically don't have a choice, there's nothing to lose, right? If I ask and he says no, my life continues like this. I'm not losing anything, right? It's just a no. I'll ask somebody else, right? It's just happened that I was lucky enough that he said yes, right? And I think the reason it kind of didn't change anything is that just that the next morning, right, I just carried on. Like the next morning, I came to the same office. I still worked on his startup, but during my lunch break, I was looking for a developer, right? And I was like, that's going to be happening now, right? And it kind of just built from that. So I kind of bit by bit, you know, got away from the startup I actually was recruited for and went full time on Hoops Connect at that time.
Sure. So I know you said you didn't do some sort of pitch deck or anything like that. You know, you just had a conversation. So anyone who's looking to get an app off the ground, would you kind of just recommend like a confidence in what you're doing and just the confidence to reach out to people? If you're in the app space, so if you've, you know, other people who who've founded apps, etc., have they ever given you advice on like if you wanted more funding, like how to find investors, etc.?
There's no better pitch deck than actually having a prototype and users that are interested, right? Like if you just have an idea and all your focus is I need to make a killer pitch deck so I get some money, that's at least not the way I do it, right? For me, especially at the moment, there are so many different tools that you can build a MVP, the minimum viable product, and get it out to a, you know, particular audience that's relevant to you, get feedback, and then only then kind of approach potential investors to believe in your idea. But the thing is that, you know, I made a mistake, I think, because I looked for a founder initially that would deal with the business side of things, even though we had a tech product. So if I had to do it all over again, I'd definitely go for a co-founder that's the developer, right? because that just supports the skill set. I design and market, you build it, right? And then the business stuff, just figure it out, right? Figure it out as you go. It's not that hard, right? It's just research. So I would probably start with that. You know, make sure either you have the skill set or find somebody that complements you and just have an MVP done and prove the concept. And if you come to an angel investor or somebody you know with that initially, that works a lot better than a pitch deck. And then it just comes down to conversation, because you can't ignore the numbers. You can't ignore the concept itself. And if the person that you know gives you money is genuinely interested, sees the value in the product, you know, he's not going to ask you for a pitch deck, right? He's just going to actually want to invest because he doesn't want to miss out. He doesn't want to be a part of that journey, right? And then the second thing, like, you have to be passionate about it yourself. Like, it came from my personal experience, right? I was actually really pissed off that there was nothing out there like that. You know, if there was, this would not exist. Like, I would just use it, but there wasn't, right? So I'm solving a problem that I've got, you know, that I'm facing. And then if that's the case, that's most likely there's other people similar to you, right? And if you desperately do need money, I would go to family and friends first, I think. If you have that luxury, like I didn't, you know, none of my friends had money, none of my family really had money. So for me, the only chance was, you know, bootstrap as much as you can, or try to build it yourself. And only when you just see no other option whatsoever, only then go and look for funding. I think there's a big misconception right now that, you know, getting funding is so glamorized, right? That a startup becomes successful because they got funding. Like, funding is nothing, right? Execution is everything. Because once you get that, you know, half a million or whatever, right? It's what you do with it. There's so many companies that get millions of in funding and then you just never hear about them, right? Just because money is not that. And if you look at a lot of the successful ones, their seed round is when they already had traction. They already were generating revenue and some of them, you know, being profitable, because then you just need the fuel to grow rather than to develop the initial product.
Sure. Okay. So I think we got up to the time where Hoops Connect started. So between that and Hoops Connect going to Orphi Active, so there's about a year difference where, you know, Hoops Connect kind of stopped. What made, over that year period, did you still have it in your mind to bring Hoops Connect back, or did you have a year of Orphi Media and then you kind of thought, you know, I've still got this burning desire to create an app that's going to
revolutionize. I completely buried it. Like, when we made a decision to cut it, that was it, right? I was so confident that somebody else will do it. And I was like, I'll just use that and I'll do something else, right? And my whole focus was on Orphi Media. And once we actually started getting clients, there wasn't even time to think about anything else. It was just full on that. And also, like, that year was quite busy. Like, I remember I moved house, I got married and all that stuff. So I didn't even have a chance to think about those things. And it's the only reason Orphi Active exists today is because I got approached by people from previously asking about it. That's the only, and then seeing that there's nothing out there still. So I just felt that there's still an opportunity to do this. Mm-hmm.
So from the year in between Hoops Connect finishing and Orphi Media starting and then Orphi Active being created, so basically from February 2018 to December 2018, what was kind of the steps between those times? So were you still thinking about the app, or what was the kind of process going on in your mind between those two times?
No, like once we pulled the plug on Hoops Connect, that was literally that. Like, we just accepted that as a failure and we just carried on. And I was just completely focused on Orphi Media, getting clients in. Once we did get the clients in, you know, then you just, all your focus and all your time goes on actually, you know, building your reputation as an agency and doing really good work. So, like, that takes a lot of time. the year overall was quite intense because I moved house, I got married. Like, there was a lot of stuff going on, so I didn't really even have a chance to think about, you know, Hoops Connect, and I just didn't see any value in thinking about it. So the only reason Orphy Active exists today is purely because by the end of 2018, people kept coming back to me asking for it. That's literally was that. And then me seeing that the market was still wide open and seeing other startups trying and failing at it, right? So I felt like I had an advantage because I failed at it already. I had cash flow coming through Orphy Media, and I still had the investor committed to trying it again. So it's like I had an advantage because now I can do it a lot faster and a lot better because I learned lessons from the previous try, basically.
Yeah, so I keep getting hit with ads of similar apps and things like that that kind of come nowhere near where you're at right now. So so you started Orphy Active again in December 2018. So over the past 2 years, like how have you gone from launching the app again to where you are today?
So the biggest thing was it was a lot more organized than it was with Hoops Connect, and it was a lot more purposeful, and we had a plan of how we're going to do it, who we're going to be targeting, what the KPIs will be, and just overall what to expect, right? So, you know, when you say we started in end of 2018, the development actually started somewhere around March 2019, because those first 3 months was all about planning, right? So we could just, from March, we had to be in a place where if we don't talk for the next 6 months, after those 6 months, we are exactly where we want to be, right? So that kind of level of communication. And so those 3 months were basically, you know, what are the features? Like, how does the MVP look like? You know, who are we targeting? How are we going to be doing it? And stuff like that, right? So from that point, from March, so development started for the next about 6 months, and we launched a private beta at around October of 2019. And the private beta was solely for us to get feedback from like about 100 to 100 people and just iterate until we get to a point where we're kind of confident enough to go public. And I basically did the unscalable. So one of the problems we had with Hoops Connect was we built a platform and crammed it with features that we felt the users would want rather than asking what they actually want, right? And our expectation was we'll build it, and if we make the branding cool and everything like that, they'll just come and use it, right? Whereas the second time around, it was literally, you know, we had the very bare bones of the concept, and then I literally went one by one meeting organizers and meeting potential participants that are going to be users, and just going through the app. And I don't know how many hours I've spent doing that, but it's literally I met like about 150 people face to face, and just going through the app, going through the concept and everything like that, and just really basically gathering intelligence of what do you need to have to be able to use it. So when we launched in this year in January, we immediately had users. We immediately had people that were looking forward to using it. And it was just a case of doubling down on that. It was a case of listening to their experience in you know, kind of real life scenarios. You know, how did those sessions come about? You know, what kind of barriers they went into and stuff like that, and just iterating really quickly. So we work in 2 week sprints. So making sure that any feedback that we get, we can tackle within 2 weeks and release that to kind of keep the retention of the early adopters, right? So obviously then COVID hit, so everything kind of went to a stop. But in the first 2-3 months, you know, we were growing quite nicely, but in a very controlled environment. So that's another thing as well. We only launched in Manchester because that's where we were based. So whenever a new user signs up, whenever somebody creates an event on the app, I would either email them, call them, whatever, and then we would then meet up. And again, I would pick their brains and really try to understand why are they on the platform, what are they looking for, and what are their pain points and stuff like that, right? So doing that scalable until it becomes kind of self-efficient enough. And that's the process. And I feel like that's what you have to do. There's nothing fancy. There's no fancy marketing tactics. There's no fancy Facebook ads. Like we barely spend on marketing at all. My main purpose at this particular time is making sure there's a product that people actually want to use and brings enough value. And only then you can start doing marketing and stuff like that to support it. Saying that, I also believe that community and kind of really focusing on your users is absolutely important, and brand awareness as well, right? So while I say, you know, here's the product, you know, and it's, I say about 30-40% is the product, the rest of it is us helping you grow, is helping build a community, and it's kind of, it's just bigger than the product. The product is just a tool, you know, but we want to get more people active. We want to get people healthy, right? And introduce them to a lot of new activities that are out there they've never heard of, you know, because a lot of people are not active because they think there's only football and rugby and tennis that they can do. But even at the moment on the app, we've got about 160 different activities to choose from. I discovered so many new ones I'd never heard of. And that's kind of the bigger picture. Belly dancing.
I saw your belly dancing video.
Yeah. No, but exactly. Like,
I'll edit that into the podcast.
Yeah, but you know, just trying those things out. I mean, it's a completely different approach than, just trying to, you know, push money into marketing, and you know, that didn't cost anything apart from time. Like, we just went on, filmed it, and posted it on social. Like that, you know, all you need is we have like a 300-pound camera. And just needed some time to edit on the software. That's it, right? But it's the experiences, it's the relationships that you build, would really helps the app get its credibility, and actually it builds not users, but it builds fans of the app. And I think that's a lot more important than kind of vanity metrics.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like brand awareness for longevity is definitely, you know, bigger than, you know, initial metrics. So, in terms of sports and building communities, word of mouth the most, you know, the most effective channel, especially if you just go if starting in the Manchester region. So, what are your plans for the future with geographically? So, I know times are a little bit different at the moment with COVID. So, what's kind of your timeline for the next, you know, 6, 12, 24 months?
So the plan is obviously to go nationwide. You know, even though kind of COVID hit and put everything to a stop, we still kind of adapted. We introduced an online workouts feature so people could still stay active and healthy online and stuff like that. But, you know, our still the main thing for us is you know, getting the participants and organizers together, you know, building a community and just, you know, them having fun and being active, right? We have enough data, we have enough proof from Manchester. So our initial plan was to launch in London in June. That obviously got pushed back for about, you know, 3-4 months, whatever it may be. So essentially, we are available nationwide now in the UK. And so, you know, it all really depends on the government's messages and what they decide on, you know, how much of the restrictions are going to be lifted. But even already, we see people really adapting and getting back to sport a bit. You know, we see netball, we see softball, and a couple of other kind of activities ramping up their stuff. So the goal is to really hit London hard by the end of the year. And make sure we've got a big offering on the app for people to choose from. Once we kind of control that environment, because it's going to be quite big, because once you hit London, you've got Manchester, you basically have more than half of the country, really. So by the next year, we really want to, you know, be available everywhere in the UK. And then the plan where to go next is, it's kind of, we're still kind of debating it right now, because, you know, it's kind of one step at a time. We need to make sure that we proved ourselves in the UK and in the concept, and we've got a really steady, good product. But the most natural expansion for us probably is Australia, just because of, you know, there's no language barrier. You know, the mindset there is very much, you know, I want to play as many different sports as I can, you know, and also the weather helps, you know, so everything is outdoors. Well, not everything, but most of the activities are outdoors. And so it kind of reduces the barriers for us of, you know, leisure centers as well. So that's kind of the next place we're looking at.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, if you go into different countries, the limitations and the, you know, the potential hurdles are a lot larger, but city to city in the UK, have you found any challenges going to, you know, say London, for example, or if you look into launch in Birmingham, have you planned for any kind of potential issues, and what are those issues?
Well, the biggest issue so far is me not being, or any of our members, because we're all based in Manchester, just not being able to go and meet the person, right? That's pretty much it, right? It's really valuable in Manchester that you can, you know, just arrange a date and you can meet them, and it's very different than, you know, just exchanging emails of feedback and stuff like that, right? But at the same time, it's a bit of a blessing in disguise with this COVID stuff, because everybody's now used to using Zoom and video calls, and so this is where we're transferring now. So we're doing like demos, you know, we're doing catch-up calls and stuff like that through Zoom. If somebody's, you know, in London or Cornwall or whatever it may be, right, where we can't just go and meet them like that. So that probably would be the biggest challenge, just not having as much control. But at the same token, the platform is in such a better place than it was in the beginning of the year, that we're a lot more confident that we don't need to handhold anymore people as we used to at the very beginning. So at the end of the day, kind of we'll have to just monitor how it happens. Like, a lot of times, you know, the more you plan, the less it goes according to plan. Yeah. Right. So you have to have like a long-term goal and vision, but then just adapt on the fly. And that's just the nature of the startup, right? You might need to pivot at any point. You might need to change things at any point, and you just need to be open to that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like you kind of got to like adapt along the way, haven't you? You don't know what's coming, but like when you're looking, I'm sure you're looking to launch in more companies and countries, but surely it's going to get to a point where it's unscalable, that you can't speak to every individual user. So once it comes to that, how will you kind of get the message out even more? You will have, you know, hopefully built up a community where there's word of mouth, but how can you continue to schedule from, you know, to get you from here to, you know, where you want to be, like one step ahead?
Good question. I don't have a straightforward answer to you because I've not done it yet, right? Mm-hmm. So again, you know, I guess I've got ideas, you know, and this is why I say community is just so important, because at some point, you know, your early adopters and the people that really believe in your idea and have a good experience, they become your ambassadors. And so they can actually take care of, you know, introducing people and how to do it, you know, leading them on and stuff like that, right? And that's what we're kind of betting on, right? But at the same time, you know, just making sure that the customer service is human, is responsive, and, you know, we're always there, right? So the beauty of today's world is that it's very much connected. So even, you know, if we launch in America or in New Zealand or whatever it may be, right? You know, apart from the time difference, there's no real barriers to actually have really good customer service and just keep people in the loop and take them through whatever needs to be, you know, gone through and introduced to what needs to be done. So My answer is not straightforward because I don't know, but I'm going to be testing out these things, and maybe that's a conversation we can have in a couple of years. But at the moment, it's kind of like taking it just step by step, because again, in startups, like tomorrow is not guaranteed. So if I focus what's going to happen in 3 years' time, I'll miss what's going to happen tomorrow, right? Like I need to, with startup, you need to really be in the moment and really try to understand your current state. And adapt to what the market is telling you right now.
Sure. So we touched on it just then, but how do you build, what are some of the tips that you can kind of say, not just for apps, but for businesses in general? How can you build customer loyalty? How can you build people who become advocates for a brand? What's worked for you in the past? What hasn't worked for you in the past? And what would you recommend?
I think it's just being human. Does that make sense, right? It's just a lot of times I see companies treating others as customers, right? As clients, as somebody that, you know, you need for them to pay you money or something like that, right? Where in reality, you just need to bring them value, and you do that by truly understanding their pain points and truly understanding where they're coming from. So as long as you're human, as long as you're just having a conversation with them rather than selling them, whatever medium you choose, whether it's through social media, whether it's through meetings or whatever else it may be, that needs to be the consistent reflection of your brand to not, as I mentioned before, not build a user base or customer base, but to build fans of your product, right? Because then word of mouth comes natural, because they don't only like your product, they like your values, and they like you as a company and then, you know, as a person. So for example, any customer service we do, any kind of reach out we do, you know, I don't, you know, we've got five people at the moment in the startup, right? Every call, every demo, everything we do, I do as a founder, because I know the product inside out, right? I can make all the decisions and I can make the changes. And if I can't do that myself and I, you know, hire like a salesperson to do that for me, that just sends, in my opinion, the wrong message, especially at the early stages, right? So, and the difference between, you know, receiving a message from the founder of the product and from a customer service person is very different, right? So that's what we're doing it right now. So far it's been working.
So I think the main point there is just you're saying that, you know, the core values come from the founder, and then, you know, hopefully that passes on to the user and they can draw that across as well. So I want to find out a little bit more about you as well. So like for you, like what was it like growing up? I know you said that you weren't very entrepreneurial or had a background in business or anything like that, but what was your like journey before, you know, like before university, and what made you want to come to London back in 2011.
I'm Lithuanian, first of all, right? I grew up with my mom and my sister, so I didn't have a dad as well. So quite early on, I was kind of the man of the house. You know, my mom was just basically working for a company for numerous of years and just doing, you know, basically some financials for them, right? And so it was just a very normal job. You know, there was some up and down, like, you know, we never really had money, like extra money or anything like that. Like I didn't starve or anything like that. Like we had, you know, a roof over our heads, I had clothes and, you know, I was fed, but that was pretty much it. And, you know, by the time I turned like 13, I knew I had to have a job. Like I never asked for money from my mom. Like I always felt like I need to bring in money and just like, cause I'm the man of the house. And once that, you know, when that becomes the mindset, like, I guess you become creative. So I don't know, like, I know I don't say I'm entrepreneurial, but I think that might be also because that wasn't even a concept when I was growing up. Like, I didn't know what an entrepreneur is until I was like 24, maybe. Like, it's like that wasn't even a word in my vocabulary, right? You know, I was always instilled by my parents that I just need to get a safe job as a lawyer, as a banker, or whatever it may be, and just hold on to the job for my dear life, because that's safety, and that's you know, that's what people in Lithuania strive for, right? Because, you know, everything else, like, you know, our history is very much, you know, survival. And so that never really spoke to me. And also, I was not a good student as well. Like, I was a very, very below average student. And that's not because, like, I wasn't capable. It's more about, I just didn't have the motivation to. It just was so not interesting to me. Because I could see through from the very young age, I could see that it doesn't make sense that, you know, what one person in a teacher, like, it says to a class of 30 people, you know, and if you disagree with that, like, you're not allowed to disagree, basically, right? It's just, that's just the way it is, and you have to learn this, and you have to memorize this, and just, that's how it is, right? And I just never liked that. So my grades were very low. I was like lazy. I was skipping class all the time. And I had this label of being a lazy student. But what people never saw is that during that time that I was missing class and stuff like that, I was doing everything else, you know. So I was really into tech. I was really into computers. Like, I was researching that all the time. I was, you know, drawing. I was breakdancing. I was like playing basketball. Like, so many different things. Like, because I will always keep myself busy, and also the fact that I needed to bring money, right? So I always find different ways to make money, right? So I remember I was selling mobile phones. I would, you know, basically flip phones. You know, I would find them for cheap, and I then would sell to somebody for a bit, you know, a bit more, and make money that way. I would find very odd hard jobs, like digging dirt, and it's literally how it sounds. You would dig dirt and you would get an equivalent to basically 20 quid for digging 1 ton, which basically takes you about 10 hours to do. So yeah, did that a couple of summers, and just all around, just always thought about different ways how I can make money. But I never thought about that, oh, this is me being entrepreneurial, or me being, you know, doing business or anything like that, right? And it never really drove me. You know, when you hear somebody else's story, like lemonade stand and stuff like that, they like got a rush from selling something. Like, for me, it's just like, I just want a pair of sneakers. I need to make this amount of money, right? That's it. It's like very, very binary, right? So that's basically the childhood. And as soon as I turned 18, I knew I have to basically run away from Lithuania, solely because I felt it was limiting me. And I never really, because I was a bad student, university was not even on my mind. But at the same time, you have a lot of pressure from the parents to go to university. So I went to Denmark because it was a very shitty university, but it was free. And it was easy to get in. So basically turned 18 and went to Denmark and studied there for 2 years. I say studied, again, did the same thing, you know, skipped class, just worked in warehouses and newspaper delivery and all that stuff. And on the side, I studied. but that was a good experience because I got away from my family, got away from Lithuania, and actually saw a completely different world in Denmark, which was a lot more open, a lot more democratic, and you know, just really opened my eyes on what can be done. And then after those 2 years, I went to London to actually study graphic design, because throughout those 2 years in studying in Denmark, I realized that graphic design and coding are two things I was really interested in, because it combined the creative, because I said I was drawing, right? So I like the creative side of things and the tech, you know, seeing that you can do a website or something like, just, you know, make something visual by typing something in. That felt amazing, right? So I went on and studied graphic design then in London. And when I came to London, then talk about, you know, opening up your eyes and understanding how much opportunity is out there.
Just to put it in context, like, so I live in the north. For when I go down south, it is like a completely different country. So yeah. From coming over from Europe, like it must be, you know, like going to Mars.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I feel very blessed that I'm Lithuanian, just because it always gives me perspective, right? You know, always remembering where I come from and kind of the opportunities I have there, which is close to none. And coming to London, where literally can do anything you want, and there's basically a customer for any idea, and like you can, you know, seeing like people in London Soho dressed up as whatever the F they want, you know, that's just wasn't a concept in my mind. So spending about 4 years in London really, really changed my mindset and really taught me that your only limitation to what you can achieve is here. And I'm, you know, on a daily to this day, I'm basically working on that. And it's been a blessing. It's been a blessing to be able to do that, because if you look back, my parents and my grandparents didn't even have the opportunity to leave the country because, you know, of being occupied and all that stuff, right? So I was the first in my generation to be just able to just travel wherever I want. And that was like, yeah, that was amazing.
Do you think that work ethic that you've got now, so the times that you were, you know, sleeping on the benches in the UK, was from the experiences you had when you were growing up? So like when you were shoveling dirt when you didn't want to, because you got through those times, do you think now you're in a better position, like that's why you stay motivated?
100%. Like just because like there was no alternative for me, mm-hmm. you know, like, and to be fair, like I didn't want to dig. Yeah, so I didn't want to dig dirt, and even London, like I didn't want to do the shitty jobs there. And when I saw some people that actually grew up in England, and there were, you know, students with me, seeing that they were like doing work in like even like a as a cashier or in some office on a minimum wage, it's like, oh my god, you can work in an office. I can't do that. Like I'm from Lithuania. Nobody's going to hire me in the office. I know nothing. So I didn't even, the thing is like, I didn't even apply for those jobs because I felt like I couldn't, right? Because that was the mindset. So if I would have to do it all over again, like I would not do the shitty jobs if I could, right? It just, at that time, it wasn't an option for me. But yeah, like to this point, you know, the reason I'm able to fail at the startup and not really think about it too much and just carry on is because what's the worst that can happen? Like I've went through so much shit that, you know, what the worst that can happen is I find a 9-to-5 job. Oh, poor me, right? It's just, it's not a thing anymore. So once you have that mindset that you can do whatever you want and it's only up to you and your mindset to make it happen and just have that kind of, I guess, grit and discipline to stay consistent and sort of go towards your goal, then yeah, that's there's no fear involved in anything.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to something, and I asked this to everyone who's been on the podcast. I think I've asked that to pretty much everyone that I've ever had on it, and I ask anyone in business that I've met as well. I think it's an important question to ask as well, and to help people who are in a similar position. And that's, you know, when learning, I mean, just in general. So how important do you think university is in general? I know that in the creative world, it's more about your portfolio. But whilst you're at university in Denmark, did you learn other things outside of the classroom that, you know, that you're still using your everyday life now?
Not in Denmark, because in Denmark, I barely went to class. I didn't really experience university there. What Denmark taught me was independence at the end of the day. I didn't need to look after my mom. I didn't need to be the man of the house anymore. Like I had the complete freedom of making my own decisions and everything like that. So at that point, like again, came into Denmark with barely no money, and Denmark is expensive, right? So I was living on pasta and ketchup for 4 months, right? And my mom didn't know. Like I didn't, again, like never asked for money, nothing. Like I was like, you know, hitchhiking to go back to Lithuania. So hitchhiking from Denmark to Lithuania. So
a long way.
Switching like five cars along the way. Could have been killed so many times and whatever, right? But again, like not even, I never even like double checked or thought of an alternative, right? It's just like, I want to go to back to Lithuania. How do I do this? I don't have no money. Hitchhike, right? Normal, like what's free? So I think it depends what you're after, right? So in London, I did experience university, right? In London, it was very, first of all, it was paid. So you're actually invested, right? It's paid. I couldn't get a loan for 3 years to get the bachelor's. I only could get it for 2 years. So for the first year, again, I had to find money. So in Denmark, I actually got money. I bought a car and, you know, had a bit saved up and stuff like that. I thought, oh, finally, I got something. And then I had to sell my car and put all my savings into the first year at university in London. So all of a sudden, I'm a zero again, right? And then I still have to pay rent and eat and everything else, right? But when you're invested, and obviously the university in London was a bit higher quality, and it's a lot more structured and there's a lot more pressure, it did teach me, I guess, the fundamentals of like maybe, you know, especially I guess writing, like expressing yourself in a really articulate manner, because I never really liked writing or anything like that. Obviously collaboration, because you were forced to do stuff with students. I was always like a loner, I guess, right? You know, yeah. I always felt like I can do what I want, I can do only by myself, because that's what I want to do, and like I can't really trust anybody to do it, and so everybody else was just a distraction. So when I think back at it, I mean those 3 years in London was, I think, valuable. But at the same time, if I had worked and did internships in different agencies and companies, I think I probably would have gotten more out of it, right? So if I had to do it all over again, I would probably not go to university, just because the experience of the real life is, I think, just so much more valuable. But again, it depends. Obviously, if you're, you know, an architect, a doctor, whatever it may be, of course, like, well, you have to, right? It's a lot more academic. But for something like that's creative, or even business school, like you don't learn business in business school, right? You learn business by trying to do business and failing and learning and trying to do business again, right? So that's just my personal point of view. So if I had to, looking back, I probably would not go to university, but at the same time, it did bring valuable skills and lessons from that.
Yeah, I'd say the same, but I guess you only know that once you've actually tried it for yourself. I say the same thing to everyone. I say that, you know, it's more about what you do when you're there. It's good to have a degree in your back pocket, so it's good.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the thing, right? So I went to university because I was almost forced, right? I was pressured into going to university. If you're Lithuanian and you don't have a degree, you're nothing. Like, we have bus drivers with PhDs in Lithuania, right? That's how effed up it is, right? So with my own kids, right, if my kid genuinely wants to go to university, please go, right? But it's never going to be, you have to go to university to do X, right? That's just not something I believe in.
Yeah, same. So when you first learned your skills of being a designer and things like that, was that all completely self-taught? And how did you teach yourself all that? Like, was that just through YouTube tutorials, or was it just through your own trial and error, that kind of thing?
So I was never able to draw properly. Like, so everything I did was self-taught. So when I say I drew like graffiti and stuff like that, right? I was very like a hip hop kid. I still am, right? And any kind of design work, I was a very bad designer in the beginning, like so bad. Like, I was in my first 2 years of graphic design in London, like I was basically at the end of the class when it came to design, right? But in the third year, because in every single year at university, I was doing some sort of an internship, right? Because I wanted to get the real life experience. And through those internships, I slowly kind of learned the fundamentals. because for some reason and in the university, they kind of expected you to know the fundamentals already and just to kind of already went to the next level. But I didn't even know the groundworks. Like, I didn't know anything about design or drawing proper faces or whatever it may be, and or terminology. And I remember in an internship in my second year, something just clicked. Literally just clicked. I was like, oh, I get it. And just from that point on, like in my third year, basically I was the best student and one of the best students at the university. And like my designs got all the attention and all that stuff, right? And everybody just like, how did you do it? And it's like, I have no idea. Like, honestly, it just clicked, right? And my designs were always, they weren't the creative type. I wasn't doing posters. I wasn't doing art. I was always like, what do I need to do to convert? Right. So if I was doing an app, a website, branding, anything, right, I was always thinking about the end user and what do I need to do for them to do an action that I want them to do. And a lot of times that meant doing a worse design that I could, just because I knew that's what would convert. And so some of my grades were actually bad because the designs were just not that great. But kind of deep down, I knew that that's what needed to be done for kind of my case study. What would happen, and sort of, I kind of transfer that to today's world. That's why I love kind of UI, UX, and branding. Is that that's all about that? Like, how can I make a user make a decision that I want them to make without even thinking about it, right? And that was something that really kind of drove me.
So, if anyone's looking to start an app, so if anyone's looking to start from the very beginning, based on the experience they've had over the last few years, what would you recommend to them? What kind of, I know there's not a direct step-by-step checklist because every situation is different, yeah, etc. At the start of it, I imagine you need to fill your own need. But what else is it based on your experience over the past few years? What,
if you can, try to avoid doing an app at any cost. No, honestly, mate, because the fact of the matter is, like, developing an app, first of all, it's very saturated, right? So to get attention is very hard. Second, it takes a lot of time to build an app properly. And third, it takes a lot of resources and money, right? So identify the problem that you're trying to solve and don't just go and do an app just because that's a popular thing right now to do. Look at a variety of ways that you could do it, and kind of the app has to be the, like, the last resort. You know, Orphe Media was just miles easier to do. It had its own challenges, but like within the first 3 months, we already had enough cash flow to support ourselves, right? And it's just because it was quite straightforward. You get a client, they pay you, you get the work, carry on, do the same thing, rinse and repeat, right? And it was very clear. And it's kind of all came down to you. When it comes to an app, there's a lot more variables, right? And there's so many things that you need to think about that. Yeah, I would probably say try to avoid doing that if you can. If you do decide to do an app, then the biggest thing I think that I see out there is people trying to do the perfect product and the perfect version of it and only then launching, right? So for you to test your idea, you don't need to write a single piece of code, like nothing. Like there's different ways depending on your skill sets. For example, as a designer, if you're a designer that cannot code, now there's so many no code apps that will allow you to get your idea from an Excel sheet, basically.
What are some of them for the listener's benefit?
So for example, the one I've used, which is brilliant, is called Glide Apps, right? Mm-hmm. So that just allows you to create a fairly robust app. Then people can have it on their phones. It's fully functional. You can have like a map, you can have lists, you can actually take payments through it as well. So you can reach a point where you're actually generating revenue without writing a single piece of code, right? If you don't have that skill set, there's also a lot of different other integrations that you can do. So like Zapier is another one, which connects a lot of different software to do what you want to do. So you can connect MailChimp to Zapier to do something, you know, maybe somebody tweets something, you know, they get something back, right? Creates a list. There's so many different things. So I think it's just in the beginning, be creative to get your idea as fast as you can out to your target audience. Then get the feedback. Do that a couple of times to kind of rinse it out and filter out. Because the thing, I'm almost 100% certain that what you have initially as an idea in your head will change once you start getting feedback from the market. Because it doesn't really matter what's in your head. It really matters what the market wants and what will they react to, right? So I would say that. So the first month to 3 months is all about testing and testing and testing and just getting that feedback. And have a clear understanding actually how you're going to make money. Again, as I said, like there's this culture of, oh, I just need funding. I don't need any money in the beginning. I just, you know, once I have enough traction, I can exit or I can get more funding or whatever it may be, right? While that might be true for some, that still shouldn't be your mindset. Your mindset should be, this is what I need to do and this is where I need to get to be fully sustainable myself, right? Because if you immediately go for, you know, the funding rounds and stuff like that, your equity will go out so quickly that by, you know, your second, third round, you'll be left with basically nothing. And you won't have the motivation to even work on your product anymore, right? So, you know, I did it initially, you know, try to bootstrap as much as you can. And then just have at least one person around you that's challenging you, that believes in your idea, and that can help you get it off the ground. So at the moment, I am a sole founder, and it definitely brings its own challenges. Obviously, having a bad co-founder is worse than having no co-founder, right? Which I learned very early on. But if I had to choose, I would love to have a co-founder as well myself, just because, especially in the beginning, it's going to be hard. Like, it's going to be very hard. It's going to be a lot of challenges. There's going to be a lot of things that you will miss as well. So having that second person to always call you out, to you know, bounce ideas off and stuff like that, I think is very, very valuable. So if I had to like pinpoint three things, is get the initial thing on a napkin, on a no-code app or whatever it may be, test the market, and surround yourself with people that will go on that journey with you, and make sure that you've got a plan how you're going to make money, you know, fairly soon. Because otherwise, yeah, you're just going to run out of money.
Perfect. Yeah. I mean, I can't get you to go into too much technical detail about the app, because as it's like designed, it's probably better to just see it rather than, you know, talk about the theory of it. But in terms of the, I guess you can't talk too much in detail about it, but like the process of actually having the idea of building the prototype, is there some sort of list you go through in your mind whilst you're building that?
So if once you've kind of validated your idea and you think, okay, we're actually going to build this now, if you're working with, so your team has to consist of the right people, right? So I would say you, depending on how many people you've got on board, having like three people to start, I think it's like the golden thing, because then you can have one person that's really good on UI, UX and design. Mm-hmm. One person that's basically always in the matrix and is just a shit hot developer that actually loves it. And then you need the third person that's basically the hustler, right? So goes out and just does all the sales, you know, maybe, you know, does a bit of analytics, you know, just calls people, just that kind of person, just get the message out, right? Once you have those pillars, you need to decide which person is not necessarily like in charge, but like the person that I guess is the project manager more than the others, I guess, right? Because there will be a case of, you know, that you'll get into disputes. Yeah. So like whatever this guy says, we'll go for basically, right? And so in terms of the development process itself, communication is absolutely key. So you don't have to just communicate, you have to over communicate. And put things in place that is very organized from the very get-go, because you'll spend a lot more time later on, you know, looking through the cracks and where things got lost and stuff like that, right? So I would immediately say project management, you know, put up a Trello or Asana or whatever other software for project management, so everybody's on track. For development, use something like Git to track all the development issues and anything like that. And then plan it out. So as a designer, your job is to create user journeys, is to create wireframes, obviously then create the designs, and just go through that iterative process and go as detailed as you can. Try to get through every scenario that you can think of, because there's nothing worse when you start developing and all of a sudden, you know, you missed out on something and a user hits a wall and there's no way to go, you know, forward or back or anything like that, right? And then for the developer, it needs to be very, very clear what happens. So you can't just go, I need a login, right? It has to be like really, really detailed. And this is where over-communication comes in. You know, what does a login actually mean, right? Are we doing email login? Are we doing usernames? Are we doing Facebook login, right? What happens when a person forgets the password? What's the process of resetting it, right? All right, we're going to need to send an email, right? How do we do that? Right? There's so many variables. And I think as a designer and a product lead, that's something you really need to think about. And then from a developer's point of view, they need to be very clear on deliverables, right? So make sure that you are not naive in your deadlines, because most of the time you're going to miss them, right? So everything, even today, like if my developer says, we're going to have this in 2 weeks, I know in my mind it's going to be a fall, just because there's always going to be something that comes in between. And your job is to reach a point where a developer says it's going to be 2 weeks. And for 2 weeks, I should not bother him at all. And in 2 weeks' time, I'm going to get exactly what's going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. And this, again, comes back to project management, time management, and everything else. But in the beginning, you won't have that luxury because you're going to be just figuring things out. So make sure that you plan for it properly. So yeah, I think those things are kind of the biggest ones at the very beginning. And just try to go out to your users as soon as you can. Like a lot of times, especially product leads become romantic about the product. And it's like, if basically there was this saying that I've heard from somebody that really is accurate, basically. And it says, if you're not embarrassed of your product when you go to launch, you're too late. So you have to be so embarrassed of your product. It has to be so bad that you get, you know, feedback so early that by the time you do launch, you know, you've got something that people actually really want. And that was the mistake we did with Hoops Connect. We waited and waited and waited until the product was perfect. And then we realized there was like half of the features we had there, people didn't even want. And because we spent time on that, the things that actually mattered didn't work. Like it was crashing, it was very slow. You know, it had some, you know, walls, you know, so the UX just wasn't good enough and all these other things. But the branding and the feature list was amazing, right? So get your priorities straight, right? So yeah, that's probably what I would say.
When it comes back to the customer feedback, so you're saying that customer feedback's like so central to everything and market research is so central to everything. What are some of the most detailed questions that you can be asking to your customer base to be getting the most out of them?
I'd probably go the other way around. Probably I would not go as detailed, right? Obviously, you need to understand what is it that you want to get from your users, right? So we can use login as an example, right? Usually, you would get ABC testing, right? So you'd have different versions. And you give it to different people, and it would just literally go, try to log in. And just all you have to do is be the stalker, right? And see how people react. Because a lot of times what happens, they have a phone, and for example, your login button is there. And a person will go, all right, it's there. So in your mind, like, okay, this is the first place they look. This is the second place they look. Then they look there, right? I need to immediately write that down and see whether that's a pattern or is that an individual case, right? And it can be as simple as, you know, changing a color, changing the size, changing the font, or whatever it may be, right? But that's the kind of, you don't ask people, do you think the font should be different? That's your decision. All you need to do for them is go and say, I want you to make X journey, X action, right? So my testing was literally try to create an event, try to join a session, you know, try to find this. And then it's just, yeah, you just look and you just watch. And that's why face-to-face meetings and testing is just basically, you can't replicate that. You know, it's definitely valuable and needed in the very beginning. So doing that scalable, I think I'll say that again and again and again, like doing the scalable and unscalable in the beginning to become scalable later on, because that will help you do the right things in the beginning. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I remember testing your app when it came into your office about a year ago now. And I just thinking back, it is probably better to get feedback in person because you can get like initial reactions, that kind of thing. Whereas if that's like written feedback or over the phone or over Zoom, Zoom's okay. But like if it's written feedback or in a, you know, Google Forms or, yeah, you know, mail, Survey Monkey, that kind of thing, you know, it's a lot better to have that face-to-face.
Yeah, because if a person doesn't understand, like if I say, find this, right, and they struggle, the biggest mistake you can do is tell them, oh, it's actually there, right? Mm-hmm. The what you need to do is like try and really pick their brains as to what are they thinking through right now? Like what are their expectations? Why are they struggling with this right now, right? So you really need to make them figure it out and see what's the process they went through to actually get to where they got, right? And then you need to shorten that as much as you can. So at the end of the day, if your app cannot be used by a four-year-old, it's not as simple that a four-year-old can book a session, then you've still got work to do basically, right? So it has to be completely idiot proof and like anybody could be able to use it, and that's a constant challenge like to this day, and we're still working on it.
It's the biggest challenge, isn't it? And we use software called Hotjar for websites, so it's not quite eyeball tracking software, but we can see like where the mouse hovers over the website and where people are clicking, where people aren't clicking, that kind of thing. So yeah, the user journey is so important, and you know, especially important for you when you're trying to, you know, build that brand awareness.
And exactly, like so you know, that's the beauty of today's world. You know, you can use something like Hotjar to do that, right? The only thing is, like, you know, that's when it comes scalable. You know, that's exactly what I mean, right? So once you've got that initial feedback, you know, you won't even have the luxury to be able to have the time and resources to integrate Hotjar into your app or something similar to that, right? You know, you want the developers to do on their thing, and then it's your responsibility to go and to do the front-facing stuff, right? And then, you know, when we're still kind of at that point, and we're definitely going to be using something to replicate the face-to-face user feedback, but yeah, it's going to be a lot more automated, literally what you just said.
Cool. Yeah. So I think we'll wrap it up there. So this is a part of the podcast where you can promote whatever you want. Like what have you got going on at the moment? Where can people find you? What's next for Orphy Active over the next 12 months?
The biggest thing probably is, you know, a lot of people will be looking for different ways to getting back to sport and getting back to being active. You know, gyms are opening up, but there's still, you know, I go to the gym now again, and it's still very crowded. It's still very awkward, you know. But you know, if you are an organizer or you're looking for something, you know, try us out. You know, download Orphy Active, give us some feedback. You know, we are still very early, so the only thing we ask is the feedback. You know, we're still at that point, and I think we will be until the next, you know, the end of the year. But apart from that, not much. Just you know, you keep doing what you're doing. You know, we're gonna, you know, stay on our mission to get more people active and healthy. And, you know, that's all we can do right now, especially at these times where I think people really are a lot more aware of what it means and the impact of not being healthy. And I think, you know, the reason kind of I personally found why I can deal with stress, I can deal with pressures, and I can, you know, deal with illnesses and stuff like that is because I go out of my way to eat healthy and be active and stuff like that. So my job and my purpose is really to kind of get that message across and then use OrthoActive as a tool to get people to where I am personally, just because I know how good it feels.
Perfect. So if anyone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to speak to you?
Probably just Google my name, really. I'm on Instagram mostly, or LinkedIn. Those are the two channels that I post the most and engage the most. I have a Twitter account. I barely use it just because it just never stuck with me. I never really understood it. So if you do want to reach out to me, just LinkedIn or Instagram, just type in my name. And apart from that, you know, if you reach out to anything OrthoActive related, you'll probably get an answer from me as well.